what could be the possible truth of such a theory in terms of the understanding of the soul and its journey and its purpose that he has already introduced. So that begins in my, you know, this new version, the Complete Works version from page 835, paragraph beginning, if this view of rebirth and the soul's temporary passage into other planes is correct.
Sure, that's what I have as well.
Okay, good. Yeah.
We read it once.
We read that once, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, this paragraph we can start with.
Okay. Vince, would you like to start reading?
Sure. Whoops. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good. Sorry. Sure. This view of rebirth in the soul's temporary passage into other planes of existence is correct. Both rebirth in the afterlife assume a different significance from the color put on them by the long current belief about reincarnation and the after-death sojourn in worlds beyond us. Reincarnation is commonly supposed to have two aspects, metaphysical and moral, an aspect of spiritual necessity, an aspect of cosmic justice and ethical discipline. The soul, in this view, or for this purpose, supposed to have a real existence, is on earth as a result of desire and ignorance. It has to remain on earth or return to it all along, as it has not wearied of desire and awakened to the fact of its ignorance and to the true knowledge. This desire compels it to return always to a new body. It must follow always the revolving wheel of birth till it is enlightened and liberated. It does not, however, remain always on earth, but alternates between earth and other worlds, celestial and infernal, where it exhausts its accumulated store of merit or demerit due to the enactment of sin or virtue, and then returns to the earth into some kind of terrestrial body, sometimes human, sometimes animal, sometimes even vegetable. The nature of this new incarnation and its fortunes are determined automatically by the soul's past actions. Karma, if the sum of past actions was good, the birth is in the higher form, the life happy or successful, or unaccountably fortunate. If bad, a lower form of nature may house us or the life. If human, will be unhappy, unsuccessful, full of suffering and misfortune. If our past actions and character were mixed, then nature, like a good accountant, gives us, according to the pitch and values of our former conduct, a well-assorted payment of mixed happiness and suffering, success and failure, the rarest good luck and the severest ill fortune. At the same time, a strong personal will or desire in the past life may also determine our new avatar. A mathematical aspect is often given to these payments of nature, for we are supposed to incur a precise penalty for our misdeeds, undergo or return the replica or equivalent of what we have inflicted or enacted. The inexorable rule of a tooth for a tooth is a frequent principle of the karmic law. For this law is an arithmetician with his abacus as well as a judge with his code of penalties for long past crimes and misdemeanors. It is also to be noted that in this system there is a double punishment and a double reward for sin and virtue. For the sinner is first tortured in hell and afterwards afflicted for the same sins in another life here, and the righteous or the Puritan is rewarded with celestial joys and afterwards again pampered for the same virtues and good deeds in a new terrestrial existence. I do remember we read that last week.
So here, this is a very important paragraph because in a nutshell, he summarizes the traditional Indian position with regard to rebirth and karma. Now, actually, one may say this is the traditional Hindu position because the Buddhist position is very similar but also has its differences. It's important to take this paragraph up because it will form the basis of his discussion of karma. And in a way, he will end up contesting most of these notions of the popular Hindu understanding of karma. Now, as he says over here, there are two sides to it, a metaphysical side and an ethical side. A side of spiritual necessity and a side of cosmic justice and ethical discipline. Now, the side of spiritual necessity is probably the most serious of the two because on it depends our understanding of the meaning and necessity of karma at all or of rebirth even. So, over there, as he points out over here in this paragraph, what is backgrounding this whole metaphysical necessity is a certain idea that whatever persists in rebirths, which first of all is a little hazy, what does persist in rebirths actually does not persist in any through any change. It remains unchanged. And it comes here from some other realm, firstly as a kind of mistake. Okay, now, there again we find a number of notions right there, but we can reduce it to a common theological problem which is present in many religions, which is the problem of original sin. That there is some kind of original error created somewhere due to which we find ourselves here in this suffering universe, in this universe of suffering, prison. So that sin, in this case, is considered to be desire. As he says over there, the soul in this view or for this purpose supposed to have a real individual existence. For a moment, we'll take that for granted because we can also consider the case where it does not have a real individual existence, as in the Buddhist case. But the soul is on earth as a result of desire and ignorance. So that is what brings it here. Now, in the Buddhist case, there is no such thing as a soul. The soul is not here because it has fallen from somewhere else. It is here because, almost in a materialistic or modern scientific sense, it is an epiphenomenon of subjectivity arising from the constituents of matter. So this thing, whether it fell from somewhere else, or whether it arose as a kind of, you know, sort of illusion. Neither case, it is held here by desire. So first we have to ask ourselves the question, what was that desire which brought it here? If it fell from somewhere else, what was the nature of that desire? Now some popular conceptions see it as a kind of operation of desire, karma, in supraphysical worlds. some Gandharva made a mistake and desired something which was not his right, and in punishment he came here. But it is not made very clear what this desire is. Some of the Upanishads also say the world was created by desire. And this has been interpreted to mean this kind of desire that ultimately propels the souls downwards here. Now, we'll keep this idea of desire in the background, on back of our minds, because Sri Aurobindo will not entirely discard this notion of desire in his metaphysics, but he gives it a different turn. He gives it a different meaning. Now, the popular notion is that whatever is desire has its own momentum. It wants to fulfill itself. It also has a lack. To have desire means that you don't have something and you want to have it. So it could not be a pure movement of Satchidananda, which in itself is completely without desire, since it has everything. So this must be a false movement to start with. Therefore, this false movement can only be remedied if and when the desire is exhausted or shown to be something false, and therefore the soul returns from where it came. This is the, in a nutshell, the metaphysical theory behind karma and rebirth. It drops here due to a desire, it accumulates more desire, and it keeps in the cycle of desire trapped in the earthly existence until by lessons it finds out or learns that desiring is not its origin. And therefore, it returns back to its origin where it gets completely absorbed. Now, that is the metaphysical notion. Now, Sri Aurobindo has already introduced an alternate metaphysical notion, which has brought us to this point, which is that this is not a movement of desire, but a movement of joy, of delight, delight of being in becoming. Through a certain kind of growth process, a experience of time as progression. So this manner of the exploration of delight is something which is experienced by the possibilities of being, each of which possibilities can be thought of as a soul, in their trajectories as beings undergoing rebirth. So the rebirth is arising due to the fact of the permanence of a entity moving towards the possession of its entire power, knowledge, infinity, delight, operating under the conditions of a nature in which it has lost all these things. So the laws of that nature are given a right on the soul, and therefore the loss of memory, the loss of power, the loss of its constituents of eternity are what it experiences and what it tries to recover. It cannot recover it in one life because it does not have the power over the constituents of its nature to do so. And hence, the challenge of death, the challenge of a personality that constantly decays, the challenge of, you know, the sense of being imprisoned is its lot until it wakes to the fact that it has power over these and reverses the process of the equation between soul and nature, Purusha and Prakriti. This is the metaphysical meaning of rebirth as Sri Aurobindo has introduced it so far. He goes further to talk about the cause of all this being the manifestation of a divine life or a divine play under conditions of ignorance, overcoming the ignorance. So that is a totally different metaphysical conception than one which believes that the soul is something which has either arisen out of ignorance or dropped into ignorance due to some wrong movement, false movement of desire, and therefore trapped here by its own momentum, causing more desire and going through cycles of the consequences and ultimately arising to some notion of knowledge. Now, of course, in this metaphysical conception also, there is a, one may say, a kind of growth process involved. But the growth process seems to be less a growth process of the Purusha than of Prakriti. Prakriti constantly is being faced with rewards and punishments, and that's where the whole ethical system comes in. And these rewards and punishments apparently will bring it at some point to the recognition of the fact that the soul has no need, that its desires are unwarranted, and evidently the soul itself, which had desired wrongfully and therefore arrived here, would have learnt its lesson and would have divested itself of its desire, of its desiring capability, and therefore gone back to its origin and disappeared there. That is the metaphysical side of things. The other side of things is the ethical side of things. And as he's pointing out over here, the ethical side of things is this rigid arithmetician with its abacus, as he says, that is constantly keeping account of good and evil. Now this becomes an extremely complex account or accounting, because as we know in our world today, good and evil are extremely relative things. How is it that we can keep account? It's the Buddhists who originally created a theory which was much more stringent, based on this idea of rebirth and karma, out of the Upanishadic statements. And the kind of theory they created is contained in a text called the Karma Vibhanga. This entire text is a very detailed text of what are the kinds of consequences that arise when somebody does something. There are very, very many kinds of actions mentioned, and each action has a very specific kind of result that one is supposed to kind of have. Now, all this ultimately leads to the point of a new birth. And these births, as he's saying, there are two things involved here. What is the overall net result that will determine the tenor of the birth? The birth is going to be a fortunate or an unfortunate birth. The internatal journey is also going to be fortunate or unfortunate. You will enter into supraphysical worlds of pleasure or of pain, according as the net result of a life's karma sort of, you know, pushes you. And then coming back to the earth, one will face, one will have circumstances again determined by the net result, either be born into a family of suffering or some kind of tremendous deprivation, poverty, subjection, oppression, etc., or something which gives one greater and greater access to freedom, wealth, comfort, and pleasure. The highest being that of the Chakravartin, the king over kings. And it is at that point, in fact, this is a kind of a hard, difficult sort of, you know, bridge to cross. But because having arrived at this tremendous freedom and kind of power over others, who would want to change those circumstances? But the idea is that that indeed is the point where the soul ultimately wakes up and decides that even here, I don't have the kind of freedom that I really deserve. That is the freedom from desire, because this whole drama is enacted through the hagiography of the Buddha himself, a king and prince who becomes a sannyasi and muni and finally enters into nirvana. So that kind of notion also persists in the Hindu idea to a large extent. See, we have the Ramayana beginning with that kind of a story where Valmiki is a dacoit who is accosted by, who accosts a band of munis and is asked by them whether anybody else will share his karma if he does harm to them, kills them, steals their goods. And of course, this little episode is taken to mean that this person will ultimately suffer tremendously for what he has done, and therefore he ought not to do it. He learns it, and then that throws him into a tremendous meditation, out of which he emerges as a sage and gives to the world the entire story of Ramayana. Now, this notion of karma as a kind of justice system, a system of rewards and punishments, is backgrounded there also, but it is kept subtly without too much definition so that there is more interpretation possible. Nevertheless, the popular notion develops out of it, which is a notion of strict vital justice, what one might call it. So this is how Sri Aurobindo foregrounds the traditional conception of karma and rebirth, both in its metaphysical and in its ethical aspects. Also, he ends by pointing out another irony to this whole thing, where he's saying, talking about the double punishment and the double reward. That is, the sinner is first tortured in hell and afterwards afflicted for the same sins in another life here. And the righteous or the Puritan is rewarded with celestial joys and afterwards again pampered for the same virtues and good deeds in a new terrestrial existence.
Devashishta, so
yes,
yeah. So these notions, could you comment on what is the origin of these notions? I mean, was it an oversimplification of an earlier theory that existed, or is it more of folklore that became accepted truth, or how do these things fall into place?
Yeah, that's a good and very difficult question to answer. I don't know. I think it is easier to say that the first of the two that you mentioned, that it is a oversimplification of an earlier theory that got distorted over time. But it may also have some kind of basis in the second. It may be a combination of the two. In fact, my sense at this time is that even things like the Veda are actually trying to integrate some high truths with some popular notions. And so what is happening is that there is a basis in popular myths and beliefs which are of this nature. And there is some kind of, you know, cryptic, you know, statement of the theory of rebirth, let's say in the Upanishads. As we've seen, if you look at the Veda, talk even of rebirth. If we look at the Upanishad, there is much talk of rebirth. But the Tathagata in the Upanishads is cryptic. It is partly symbolic and it is partly get towards the exceeding of the subjection to birth and death. But it is taken for granted. So whatever this is that is taken for granted, not developed into a theory in the early period, perhaps meets these popular conceptions and becomes this kind of normal Hindu notion and Buddhist notion. I think it passes through two phases, the Buddhist phase, and then enters into the Hindu phase and develops this kind of idea. Now, to this, there has to be add another strand or element which has been very, very successful. And actually, the Ramayana story points to that. And that is that in India, the ethics that has developed, the system of ethics as against the system of spirituality, that is what holds society together. Dharma in its social aspect has been tremendously aided by the internalization of ideas of this kind, that we have not really taken these ideas as external ideas that need to be enforced through justice systems. That has been there, but much more powerfully because these ideas have been internalized. How much more powerful it is if a person from childhood believes or is made to believe, socialized to believe, that these kind of ideas pertain to the afterlife and to innumerable lives after. It's very difficult to shrug away such ideas if they are presented to one as the truth given by the scriptures and that actually pertain to one's afterlife. So it acts as a very strong ethical force, which has been successful, in fact. But all societies, I think, have some degree of internal socialization, which is based on the afterlife. That ultimately is the positive though distorted function of religion. Those in seeking for truth have to question these things. But nevertheless, at the social level, it is a very powerful device for keeping a society together.
So, apart from keeping the society together, what is the real basis of these notions? Is there any truth? I mean, even if you look at Gita, it seems to suggest that, okay, if you continue your sadhana, you will be born in a more conducive environment next time and you will take it from there. There also it seems to suggest that, yes, there is this notion that it is this accounting is carried forward and all those implications are there, right? So there must be some basis for this accounting notion apart from holding the society and internalization.
Yes. Now the thing is that there can be there must be some sort of truth, as you say, to these ideas. But this truth is of a much more subtle nature. That is the thing. I mean, what is popular and oversimplified is this strict notion of justice, which is working out on the life plane. You see, the plane of rewards and punishments and pleasures and pains is quite different from being told you'll take birth in the family of sadhaks if you follow on the path towards the spiritual life. Because that is not really a pleasure. You see, the thing is, the Gita's notion is already linking the rebirth to the growth of consciousness. While in these notions, there is no linking to the growth of consciousness. It is a kind of a binary reality that we are faced with. Either we are in ignorance we are constantly cycling through rewards and punishments, building our desire and being impeded in our desire. And ultimately, as a binary, as a discrete jump, we are actually shown that this is all illusion, and we end up either completely dissolving this thing called the soul or jumping into union with something which doesn't have any desire. But if we turn it in another direction, then we see other ways of looking at these things. As you said, the truth of these things may be there, but may be much more subtle. It may have nothing to do with this kind of reward and punishment system of the vital. It may have something to do with the growth of consciousness. And so the very metaphysics, as he pointed out, the metaphysics behind this is very different from the metaphysics he is giving to us. If we take that kind of metaphysics, then we find that the whole equation, the relation between nature and soul, and the experiences that nature has to give us, and the meaning of the soul's rebirth, taking of circumstances, is a different one. There too, some of these things may come into play, as you want to put. Nature has a certain kind of law of causation working in it. These laws are not merely laws of matter, not merely laws of mind, but they're also laws of life, which have a certain kind of natural movement in them. One of them is very simple. He says that it is very simple and easy to realize whatever we concentrate our energy in is ultimately going to cause an accumulation of that kind of form of energy. See? So we bring to ourselves whatever we concentrate on. That is one particular natural sort of law which is active, and behind which one can find the action of some kind of will within the human being. Now that will is under the conditions of nature, and therefore it has a desire within it. But that is one thing. The other thing is that life, cosmic nature, operates through certain forces. And these forces themselves have their correlates within us. If we, in a way, at our life plane, at our vital plane, find very easy this whole law of reward and punishment as a means for not only ethics, not only social justice, but also for as a means for growth, as a means for the development of our capacities. This whole idea of reward and punishment at the external level has a certain truth only for the vital being. So in cosmic nature also, at the pranamaya level, at the level of the vital plane, the life worlds, some laws of this kind are active. I mean, there is some seed of truth there as well. But it cannot be made to account for the meaning of the soul's rebirth. It forms a strand. It forms a small, insignificant or relatively significant portion of the soul's rebirth process. But it is not, it cannot be held to be the truth of it.
Thank you, Devashishta. Thank you very much.
Monica, would you like to read the next paragraph?
Actually, I have one more question.
Sure.
Does other religions like I don't know. I mean, Christianity and Islam, do they have this notion of rebirth?
No.
Is it similar?
So you see, all the Judeo-Christian religions. Yeah, there the accounting is. You see, he points out at the end of that. Of the irrenable accounting, you see, it's like he says a double punishment and a double reward. That is, you are tortured first in hell. Again, non-Puritan is rewarded with celestial joys and again pampered on earth. That problem of double sort of taken care of there, because they give all the rewards and all the punishments in the afterlife. So there is no necessity for coming here. We have to wish soul return here. Unless there is a certain kind, either an evolutionary journey that is undertaken, or there is a law by which it is stuck here. Now, in the Hindu-Buddhist system, there is a law by which it is stuck here, of desire. And there is a truth, I mean, there is a power there, because the Buddhists even need a soul to posit it. They are saying it is the constituent consciousness which have the characteristics of the constituents of material nature. Because things in material nature abide due to the force which is in them. Something once started does not disappear. So too, the elements of consciousness persist. The walls, whatever is within it, continues by its own momentum, because there is an engine driving it. And that engine, I think there is a profound truth there that is much greater than what these Judeo-Christian religions have caught on. Even without evolution, the gratification for rebirth, but it does not satisfactorily allow for this problem of double reward and a double punishment. One could easily say that that momentum is carried on in other worlds, not on this physical frame. Again, there we find that Sri Aurobindo's answer is much more, you know, in this, it can only keep taking other material frames, because the soul has chosen to master all the elements of nature. Take this kind of defeat of the physical death to be its ultimate subjection. It is ultimately not subject to anything, and persist in its project of self-mastery and mastery of nature from life to life.
Shall I read?
Sure.
Shall I read?
Yes, why don't you?
Okay. These are very summary notions and offer no foothold to the philosophic reason and no answer to a search for the true significance of life. Work only as a convenience for turning endlessly on a wheel of ignorance, with no issue except a final chance out of it, is not a world with any real reason for existence. A world which serves only as a school of sin and virtue and consists of a system of rewards and whippings does not make any better appeal to our intelligence. The soul or spirit within us, if it is divine, immortal, or celestial, cannot be sent here solely to be put to a school for this kind of crude and primitive moral education. If it enters into ignorance, it must be because there is some larger principle or possibility of its being that has to be worked out through the ignorance. If, on the other hand, it is a being from the infinite, plunged for some cosmic purpose into the obscurity of matter and growing to self-knowledge within it, its life here and the significance of that life must be something more than that of an infant coddled and whipped into virtuous ways. It must be a growth out of an assumed ignorance towards its full spiritual stature, with a final passage into an immortal consciousness, knowledge, strength, beauty, divine purity, and power. And for such a spiritual growth, this law of karma, that even if the soul is something created, an infant being that has to learn from nature and grow into immortality, by a larger law of growth, and not by some divine code of primitive and barbaric justice. This idea of karma is a construction for a smaller part of the human vital mind concerned with its petty rules of life and joys and sorrows, and erecting their puny standards into the law and aim of the cosmos. These cannot be acceptable to the thinking mind. They have too evidently the stamp of a construction fashioned by our human ignorance.
So, this is a short paragraph, but quite a strong critique. He's quite strong in this paragraph in pointing out that these kind of notions don't give any foothold to the philosophic reason, nor do they really give us any true sense, inner intuitive sense of the significance of life, of the human life. Somehow they only satisfy a very superficial understanding, puerile as it says, of the meaning of life. If the human existence is one which is that of a soul that ultimately is extremely conditioned, the whole notion of a conditioned soul that cannot exist in its own right except through the schoolings of nature or outside of nature completely, then this can be taken for granted. But as he says, if the soul is a being from the infinite, plunged for some cosmic purpose into the obscurity of matter and growing to self-knowledge within it, its life here and the significance of that life must be something more than that of an infant coddled and whipped into virtuous ways. It must be a growth out of an assumed ignorance towards its own full spiritual stature, with a final passage into an immortal consciousness, knowledge, strength, beauty, divine purity, and power. For such a spiritual growth, this law is all too puerile. So that is ultimately the vision of the soul. If the soul, and then that will rest not merely on some kind of speculation about what is the soul and its place here, whether we keep a very powerful and daring instead of the soul and take on a more modest, you know, role for the soul over here. But ultimately it will rest on our innermost intuition of the soul itself, of what we are here for. And then So I was, when we got cut off, I was saying that Sri Aurobindo is also calling the notion of the role of the soul, its metaphysics, as developed in the Vedas and the Upanishads, where it is really as an aspect of the infinite being and its self-concentration. It's what he calls its multiple self-concentration upon itself, that the souls arise, and therefore each soul is nothing but the infinite one in manifestation in a certain way, in a certain modality. If that is the case, then it cannot be a constrained life in which it is conditioned by the laws of the lower vital or any surface vital that can keep it what it is.
I think we lost Debashish. Can anybody else hear him?
No, I had muted my mic. I think I finished with what I had to say. I was saying that basically that's the the role of the soul is, you know, if it is to be seen as a self-manifestation of the infinite being, in infinite perspectives of self-knowledge, power, beauty, as he says over there, all those qualities, divine qualities, then it cannot be one which is constrained by what he's talking here as the petty rules of life and its desires and joys and sorrows.
So the way of looking at, one way of looking at it is as though it were a punishment and a reward, and on the other hand, the notion that whatever area or whatever your focus is, that's what you will attract, or that's what the momentum tends to satisfy itself. So they are in a way, I mean, different ways of looking at what is the same end result, so to say, right?
No, not necessarily. And also to say that on the one hand it is reward and punishment, and the other it is forces bring to them whatever they are sort of concentrating on, also does not cover the whole story, you see. Forces, when concentrated, bring certain results. It's a person who wants to concentrate on money gets a lot of money. Get troubled or not because he has a lot of money. What challenges does money bring to the consciousness? It has nothing to say about that. About innocent sorrow, you see. So that amoral sort of perspective, which is perspective two, into perspective one and perspective two, that it's not just perspective one in an amoral form is equal to perspective two. Three different ways of looking at things, and these things don't necessarily amount to the same results. Secondly, may coexist perspective with perspective two in a limited sense, and that is why it is a much more complex reality than giving any one of these perspectives. The math of them are realities, in their own place and to their own degree. But more than either of them is the fact that there is a soul growing. Tapisakta being made use of by the soul and also being conditioned by the soul. To the degree that the soul emerges in power, it becomes destiny. What is coming to you is no longer going to be what the laws of nature bring you, but the laws of what of the laws of nature.
Yeah, thank you, Devashishta.
Devashishta, it sounds like that the process of rebirth is applies to different beings. It seems like in the traditional notion, it's not the rebirth of the soul, but it's the rebirth of a vital being or a desired soul. Whereas in the Gita and Shurvindo, or particularly in Shurvindo, the rebirth is applying just to the psychic being. Does that make sense?
Yes, indeed, it makes sense. Yes, it does. And you see, the reason that we can think about such a kind of reward and punishment system is because there must be something in the constituents of our nature which are something in cosmic nature. And that which is in cosmic nature is in that particular plane of the vital. So if we were vital beings who are operated entire in that particular way, rather than psychic beings that have various constituents of nature within us, then we could have justifiably said that that is all of our existence. But it cannot be all of our existence because it is only a small part of our nature that it is ruled by cosmic forces of that kind.
Thank you.
Are others also experiencing a lot of breaking up when Devashishta is talking?
Yes.
Shall we do one thing? Maybe we can drop the call. Maybe I'll try hosting, see if it is.
Yeah, especially I think the last.
Maybe we can try that.
Yeah, the last 5 to 10 minutes, I think it's kind of increased a bit. So, Devashishta, shall we do? Do you mind if we spend a minute doing that?
Break it in.
Sure.
Yeah, let's do that then.
So perhaps we can move on to the next paragraph unless anybody wishes to comment any further.
For me, this is a very totally different perspective altogether. I never even heard of this. I always looked at it as some kind of accounting, holistic. It's so refreshing for
yeah.
me. Learn that. It's such a rewarding thing.
Yeah, it is. Of karma and rebirth is totally ingrained in the Indian consciousness.